This show furnished by Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn.
It's time for Gervy's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervy. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. Joined today by his co-host, radio personality, and television host, Kerry Kasem. Kerry brings a fresh, real perspective to the intersection of law and life, turning Murphy's Law upside down. And now, here are Alan Gervy and Kerry Kasem.
Good afternoon, Los Angeles, and everyone listening all over the world on KBC.com. I am Alan Gervy, and I'm the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn. And today, as usual, I am here to be the managing partner of your life. And I just lied.
You did.
I said I'm here to be the managing partner of your life. Kerry Kasem is there.
I am.
In studio to be the managing partner of your life. And I'm just some guy on the telephone.
I don't think so. You're working. You're working hard.
Working.
I'm here. Working. You know, it's a weekend, but that's what you do when you have to.
Labor Day. Labor Day weekend.
No, and you're laboring.
What does Labor Day mean, Kerry? I'm working.
You are laboring.
I'm laboring.
That's okay.
That's what you do during Labor Day weekend. You work the full weekend. Isn't that what you're doing on your Labor Day weekend, Kerry?
You know, I do tend to work all the time. So I guess this is work, but it's fun work. I love radio. To me, is, you know, and for us, it's easy. We've been doing it for so long. But when you have, you know, the law to deal with and you have cases to deal with, that's, you know, that's real work there. So
but you have been practicing a labor of love, because the work that you do, you are so committed and you're so passionate about.
Oh,
that
thanks.
It really doesn't seem like work to you.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. And I've been doing a lot of it lately. A lot, unfortunately, a lot of people dealing with elder abuse. You know, it's getting worse and worse and worse. So hopefully in the next few years, we can curb that with Kasem Cares and help more people. So you're right.
I know that you are doing such wonderful work. And unfortunately, I didn't see you last week. We had a wonderful show when we had Gloria Allred on. We were talking about the induction into the National Women's Hall of Fame, which takes place in September 14th. And she did a great show for Gervy's Law last week. She was dancing to the song Gloria, and we got that on tape. If you go to our Facebook page, you can see Gloria dancing to Gloria.
Gloria.
And then
Gloria.
What she did was the next day she took Red Eye and went right to New York to be involved with the Weinstein and Epstein trials.
Oh,
Weinstein
wow.
On past Monday, and Tuesday was Epstein. And there she was doing this press conference after the Weinstein hearing in New York.
You know,
amazing.
She is amazing. And I wonder, did she ever talk about getting dressed by one of our other guests, Ivan Biton?
She didn't talk about it. I didn't want to ask her. She was wearing, if you go to our Facebook, you'll see what she was wearing. And that was on her way to the airport to go to the hearing. So I don't know what she's going to wear on September 14th, but she was wearing a very attractive red print flowery jacket. And she dresses so impeccably.
Yeah.
She kind of looked like the 76-year-old that I saw the next night. I flew to Phoenix this past week to see the Stones in concert in Phoenix. I was a guest of one of the sponsors of the show, of the tour, and we had front row seats, and I watched Mick Jagger and his buddies, all in their 70s, running, jumping around the stage, and I thought of Gloria, and I'm thinking, wow, age is really just a number. Gloria's up there over 75. I won't say her age. I'm not sure that she cares if I do. And then there was, you know, Mick Jagger and Ronnie Wood, and of course Keith Richards and Charlie Watts. And they were all in their 70s doing amazing work. So, Kerry, the work that you do for people who are getting up there in age, and then you see these other people who, on their own, are just amazing, amazing. The moves that Mick Jagger had sounds like a song. He really had the moves of Jagger.
You know, the first time I saw the Stones was in Phoenix. I was invited too, and we were right up there in the
really?
The first couple rows. Yeah,
wow.
That was the first time I ever saw them. The last time, actually. I've seen performances at different award shows, but I've never been to a whole concert again. They're amazing. They're really amazing. And there is a difference between people who are older or elderly, really, because you can be old and still have a kid's spirit and a kid's body. And, you know, you just, your body's older, but you're still moving around like, you know, you're in your 30s or 40s. And then you can be truly elderly where you're in your 60s, 70s and not doing well, you know, and walking, you know, not being able to walk or bedbound, which is horrible. Horrible.
Why is that? You're an expert.
I think it's the way you take it. First of all, number one thing is your mind. It really is. Because you see people who eat bad, they smoke, they're drinking, and they're still up and around. It is your mind. It is your thoughts. It is your positivity. It's your ability to just, like, overcome things and stay positive. That's it. I've seen this. When you are negative, you're upset about things, you're critical, you're constantly complaining, that drives your health down. Second is the way you live, too. I mean, there's some people who can drink every day, and they're living into their 80s and 90s. And then there's some people who do yoga, like the woman who's, I think she's 101, who's still teaching yoga in New York. So
are you telling me, Carrie, that the Stones never did any drugs?
No, they did a ton of drugs, and I don't know how they're doing it. But I'll tell you, they also stopped all that, and they got into health and into certain blood transfusions and ozone therapy and things that cost a fortune. But I really do believe that when they started to get healthy, they really, really did and concentrated on that. And I think that's what's keeping them going.
Between the four of them, there wasn't 1 ounce of fat on that stage. Oh. It was crazy how thin.
Yeah.
They are in their 70s. Crazy.
They also live in Europe most of the time, and they don't allow certain GMOs and poisons that America allows in their food here, which is amazing. So I think that has a lot to do with it, too.
They spend enough time in this country to get poisoned.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Carrie, tell us about the show we're doing today.
I'm really excited.
I sit here listening to you. I wish I was there with you. Go ahead. Tell us.
Well, we have director Pat McGee on who he made the film The Deported. And it really is a timely film because of what is going on in the United States today, which I'm all for immigration reform. I am not all for taking people who have lived here their whole lives or taking people that are good citizens and throwing them back in a country that will punish them either with, you know, lifetime sentences in jail or murder or, you know, they'll kill them. I'm not okay with that. That is not okay. And they've done this now a few times where people get deported and they die. And I'm not okay with it. So I did watch the trailer and I did read about this. And there are four families who are going through a lot because of what is happening right now. So I'm excited to talk to Pat.
But I find it so hard to believe, Carrie, because I read about those four families and they seem like they're so entrenched in our society.
Yes. Yes.
And we have to find out. And you know, we can ask Pat tough questions. Pat McGee will be on shortly. If this is really true, are these people who have families here, who have children, who were born in this country, are they being threatened with deportation?
They are. You know, there was a story about a Michigan man who was mentally ill that got deported back to the Middle East. And he was dependent on insulin. He was not well. Yes, he did commit a crime. I think he broke into someone's house. He didn't hurt anybody. But because of that, they sent him back. He was born in the United States of America. And they sent him back. He was born outside and came back in within his first year, was in the United States of America, raised in the United States of America, only spoke English. They deported him. And within, I think it was 9 days, he was dead. And I don't understand that. That doesn't make sense. And why isn't this not on an individual basis? Why are they rounding people up, the good and the bad? They should throw the bad people out, the people who are committing the crime, the people.
Well, maybe people can learn from The Deported, the movie, as to what's really going on. And I'm not sure if it really is, but if it is, you know, we've got to really think about how to fix this problem.
Yeah.
We also have Sarah Deer coming on, and I'm excited to talk to her. Last week, we had Kate Bennett on our show when we had Gloria Allred on, and she's the chair of the National Women's Hall of Fame. And she was telling us about the inductees for this year, Sarah Deer being one of them.
She's fantastic. She wrote an award-winning book called The Beginning and End of Rape, Confronting Sexual Violence in Native America. She's a powerhouse. She's absolutely a powerhouse, and I'm very excited to talk to her as well. She's addressing the widespread violence against Native women And, you know, somebody's got to do this. And there's always, if you've gone through it or something has affected you, like what happened with me and my family, you become an advocate. You become passionate about it. And that's what you have to do to change things in this country.
And she's a professor of law at the University of Kansas School of Law. She has a whole lot of credibility. So it's something that we all should learn from. And I know that Kate Bennett was so excited when she heard we were going to have Sarah on the show.
Yeah. Well, we have another 2 minutes. I want to know what's going on with you and what's happening. I know I'm like seeing you and I follow you, Alan, on your social media. But it looks like you're along with work. It looks like you're having fun.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, no one told me that having a 5 and a 6 year old would require this much work. I guess I should have known. And I'm coaching my daughter's 5 year old softball team, and I'm coaching my son's 6 year old baseball team, as well as taking them to dance and hockey and football and basketball. And it's just been so busy, and I'm thankful that Nancy has been with me on the team, because we're doing a lot of running around taking the kids, and they seem to be loving it. So hopefully we're enhancing their ability to enjoy their life before life really becomes stressful.
Now, I don't, you know, I don't have kids. I have cats. I don't. And honestly, my life is so busy. And this is what people always say, you have to be a mom or dad to realize what this is like. So for me, I don't know how you do it all. I watch it. And the fact that you run your own business, you have a law firm, you know, you and a partner have a law firm, and you're running that whole thing. You're in court all the time. You do this radio show and you do everything else. It blows my mind. I'm busy, but I can't say that I know what it's like having kids and trying to do everything at the same time. So congrats to you. Wait a minute. Where's the clapping? Where's the audience clapping?
Okay. I don't need the clapping. You don't do it for applause.
There we go.
You do it because you are passionate. I don't want applause. You do it because you're passionate, and you know, and it's funny because it becomes second nature, and you know this. You've done so many talks. I do a lot of panels, and I do speeches, and I'm educating. And this past week, I did a speech at a presiding judge's going away party, and it becomes much easier. You don't feel as stressed when you do it all the time. So it's just a matter of course. It's just another day's work, and I know you feel that way with all the talks because you're everywhere. Speaking about different subjects.
I am. We got to take a break. You're listening to Gervie's Law. Alan Gervie, I'm Carrie Kasem, right here on 790 KBC.
Welcome back to Gervie's Law, lifting Murphy's Law to the highest level on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
This is Gervie's Law. I'm Carrie Kasem. We got Alan Gervie on the phone today.
Never happened before. It's Labor Day weekend and I'm working. It's Labor Day. I take it very literally. Not taking the day off.
No, you don't take the day off.
I gotta prepare trials. My clients don't take a back seat to Labor Day.
No, they don't. And neither does the man that we are about to talk to, Pat McGee, who is a director. He's a filmmaker. He made The Deported, and it's a very timely film, a film about undocumented people here in the U.S., or people who were not born here, and just being deported. Four stories that are really heart-wrenching, and I'm having such a hard time with it myself. My family comes from, you know, Lebanon myself, and people that I know could be deported. And, you know, Pat, you are an award-winning director in both film and television. You're a Michigan transplant. You're from where my dad was born and raised. And I have a heart, you know, there, because all my family's still there. And we have a lot of people who have moved here from Lebanon who are worried, who do have this issue right now. And welcome to the show. Oh, welcome to Gervie's Law.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate that. Such a kind and very sweet open. Thank you.
You're very welcome. So tell us a little bit about why did you decide to go into this genre? What made you so passionate about it?
You know, that's a good question. You know, first, I'd like to, you know, just point out the obvious that this film, you know, it's not possible without the people that we follow, the subjects, you know. The people that they deserve a lot of credit because they have a target on their backs, and you know, they're brave individuals and brave families that let us tell their story. So I think, you know, it's so sweet when people say, "How'd you get involved with this?" And I think it's one of those things that, you know, for the filmmaker, you're attracted to. There's a lot of great people behind this film. And I was brought in to direct and show on it. And, you know, it goes without saying there's a company called Green Couch Entertainment and Critical Content. And they're great people that, you know, are trying to do important work. And I'm just lucky to be part of it. You know, I really try to gravitate, myself and my team gravitate toward telling stories that really matter. And I couldn't be more timely with this, you know, with everything that's going on with Trump administration, zero tolerance, stance to integration. And it was just the amount of hate he's spewing right now. It just seemed like this was a no-brainer. And I'm just privileged and honored to be part of it.
Pat, how did you find the four examples, I guess we can call them examples, because I'm sure there's a lot of them throughout the country, but these are so poignant, these four examples, four families that are involved. How did you find them, and were there others that were equally as seemingly egregious?
Oh, absolutely. You know, there's a gentleman, Gordon Stanley, and he was a big part of this project. He kind of created the idea. He had contacts through a lot of immigration attorneys that he had reached out to. And this is just four samples from across the country. And there are so many more. It was so fluid in the time that we were trying to shoot these stories that there were other cases that we really wanted to be involved with where either they went underground or they had been deported. And so it was something that, you know, as a crew, we really had to act fast and try to collect as much, you know, content as possible. I really think it's such a good cross-section of the country because, you know, we're in San Diego, Detroit, Connecticut, and Miami. And, you know, you follow these families over the course of the year, and you really don't know what's going to happen. And, you know, your heart just bleeds for them because, you know, these people are just, you know, the one thing is, I think, you know, with Trump and Trump administration policy, you know, they try to cast this fear of these people being criminals and rapists, and it couldn't be any further from the truth. I mean, these people, you know, we're looking at people that are, you know, coaches and volunteers and you know, people that we play with, they're, you know, they're part of our community. They are our community. And, you know, once you get to know these people, and that's the idea, is like, if people can really see who these people are that we're trying to deport, you'd understand that they're our family, they're our country. And,
I wanted to ask you, because you mentioned immigration lawyers, and obviously you talk to a lot of immigration lawyers. Some of the cases that you focus on in the film, The Deported, seem to have some issues with regard to what the law is. When you talk about, for instance, the Albanian family in Detroit who has a son at college and an American-born high schooler who risk being in the foster system if their parents and brother are deported, how is that possible? A lot of people in this country want to know, if you have a kid that's American-born or in college or any other type of integrated family member in society, how could a sibling or a parent be deported, leaving these people on their own, essentially?
You know, that's a really good question. And, you know, I'm not an attorney or an immigration legal expert, but I can tell you from spending time with them, you know, this family, as we were explained, that, you know, the one kid who's, you know, in high school, the other one is in college. Now, if they were deported, if he was deported, the idea was he would be deported, and his wife, who was battling MS, and Deb Reisberger was the primary caregiver, if he was deported, the wife was going to be awarded to the state because she was also there illegally. So they basically said that, you know, she would be awarded to the state into care, and his son would as well. It's absolutely devastating. I mean, this guy made a decision to stay with his wife. He said he took a vow to be with her for the rest of his life, and he's going to honor that. And at the moment, right now, an update on that case is ICE has declared him a fugitive, even though they know where he is. He's in sanctuary at that church. And they battled, and they tried to appeal that status of being a fugitive, and they lost. So right now, there's probably no clear pathway for him to stay here outside of that sanctuary. It's devastating.
It's absolutely devastating. You know, one of my family members through marriage, a doctor, opened up a clinic and was helping the poor in Florida and was having this problem as well. It's like, wait a second, I have a clinic, I'm helping the poor, I'm not making that much money, I've dedicated my life to low-income families, I've opened a clinic, I have doctors under me, and you want to send me back to Lebanon? Why? What's going on here? You know, what's really happening here? Why are they not looking at people on an individual basis? What's happening?
It's such a good point, and I think, and again, this is my opinion, when Trump administration says, look, we're going to, you know, deport all these people, they thought they were going to round up all these violent criminals.
Yeah.
And they thought that this was going to be like this big violent, you know, roundup of criminals. And if they existed, which, you know, super, super small percentage of them are violent criminals, but, you know, if they existed, they couldn't find them. So what they decided to go and do is round up the people that are outstanding members of our community, that pay taxes, that are part of our community, that are easily identifiable. I mean, if you look at the family in Connecticut, you know, it's a family of four, two kids, six and three. They've been here 17 years, you know, middle class, beautiful family, and they pay taxes every year. They couldn't be any more American. You know, the father-in-law is a Vietnam veteran, you know. I mean, it's like, it's unbelievable, you know. It's like they're part of our community. And recently, you know, they were deported, but Joelle was deported, and the family decided to relocate down there. Just recently, we were at a film festival, and Samantha was coming back, and she was, you know, the trailer for the film has been viewed 38 million times, which is a lot.
Wow.
And she was identified at the airport, and she got into a verbal, some verbal abuse, a verbal conflict, and then it escalated. And it was just horrible. You know, she's coming back here to be part of a panel, be part of a discussion, and then she's eventually attacked at an airport in New York.
Wow.
Now, Pat, I was going to say, listening to you, and I know that you were so passionate about this in a statement you made. You said, I keep pushing to give a voice to the voiceless while respecting the art of storytelling. You did that in your Dope Sick Nation, which was a documentary that I guess came out about the time when you were filming The Deported. And now that The Deported is out, what are people saying? Have they opened their eyes? What has the reaction been to The Deported?
That's a really good question. It has been, you know, online, it has, it's been polarizing, unfortunately, to some extent, because we're looking at a bunch of alt-right people that, you know, in my opinion, live in fear. And it's, you know, 38 million views of our trailer. Half of them are, you know, not on board with, you know, a better immigration policy. So it's, you know, we're raising awareness, and the most important thing we can do is let people understand personal stories. If we can communicate with people and let them know, like, look, these aren't numbers, this isn't a stat, these are real people. And just as you said a second ago, it's like, you know, we need to look at this not as black and white. People are not, you know, black and white. It's gray. And, you know, we need to fix immigration policy. There's no perfect solution other than saying, you know, and Rosario Dawson says this in the film, it's like, what sort of country do you want to live in? You know, what do you want to represent as a country? It gets back to humanity. At the end of the day, it's like, we are a country of immigrants, and, you know, how do we want to treat each other? And that's what it comes down to, I think.
Yeah, I think there definitely needs to be immigration reform. People do need to immigrate here legally, though. I believe in that. But I do not believe in throwing out people who've lived here their whole lives. That doesn't make any sense. And it's not okay. But there needs to be some kind of immigration reform where we allow people to come here, where it doesn't take 10, 15, 20 years. So,
you know, Carrie, I think a lot of people have opinions on this. And as Pat said, polarizing.
Yeah.
People should be able to make the decision themselves. If they see The Deported, I know that it opens up eyes and it gives people who may be doubters to certain policies or the media, because we never know what's really going on. But if they can see the film, they can get an idea of some of the situations anyway that are real life and maybe make their own judgments after that. What's the best way, Pat, to see the film?
I just want to add to what you're saying. I think that's a really good point, because really at the end of the day, if people get a chance to watch the deported, it can create a conversation, and a smart conversation, instead of it just being black versus white or us against them. And if you can start a conversation, that's the first step. And I think that's just adding to what you said. The best way to see the deported, it's a YouTube original film. It's on YouTube. It's on their pay YouTube. Just go to thedeported.com and it'll be there. I really appreciate you guys taking the time and letting us talk about this film.
That's an excellent point you make, and I think everyone should heed that point, because you really need to get the conversation going, and you've got to bring down the emotion. It's incredible, because when you see the film and you see the trailer, Pat, you are really taking a step back and presenting something to the public. You're not screaming and yelling just from your tenor on this interview. You really believe in letting people make decisions, informed decisions, and coming up with ideas of their own and getting this conversation started, versus screaming and yelling like a lot of people for one side or the other. And that's the most important first step, I think, in this issue.
Absolutely. There's no one silver bullet or right answer, and it's going to be, it's going to be difficult to fix this broken immigration system. But if we just look at it in terms of humanity and how we want to treat people and how we want to be treated, that's where we begin. And it's not going to be easy, but, we have a lot of smart people in this country, a lot of caring people, and that's going to reflect eventually in our immigration policy.
Yeah.
Well, good luck with it, Carrie.
Yeah, thank you so much, Pat McGee. So go to YouTube, or just actually thedeported.com, and watch this film and do something about it. If people just sit there, become an advocate. If you're passionate about it, do something about it. You're listening to Gervie's Law. I'm Carrie Kasem. Alan Gervie is on the phone, but we will be right back with Sarah Deer on 790 KABC.
Welcome back to Gervie's Law, turning Murphy's Law upside down on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
It is Gervie's Law with Alan Gervie, who's on the phone. I'm Carrie Kasem in studio. It's Labor Day weekend, and Alan is laboring.
I am laboring. I'm working. First time I'm not in the studio. Carrie, are you missing me?
I am. This is so weird, sitting in your spot.
Yeah, well, I missed you last week when we had Gloria Allred on, and she co-hosted the show with me. And during that show, we had Kate Bennett call in from Seneca Falls, New York, which is the home of the National Women's Hall of Fame, Kate Bennett being the president of the National Women's Hall of Fame. And I'll tell you, Kate's most excited moment on the show was not talking with Gloria Allred or discussing all of the 2019 inductees. She got so excited when I said, "Oh, Kate, next week we're going to have Sarah Deer on the show."
Yeah.
And she said, "Oh, I'm so excited about that. I'm so happy." So Sarah Deer is obviously someone who Kate Bennett really respects and is thrilled that she is going to be an inductee this year into the National Women's Hall of Fame with people with illustrious careers like Gloria Allred, Jane Fonda, Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor, Angela Davis, and Rose O'Neill, and a few others, Diane von Furstenberg.
Oh, yeah.
What a class in 2019. And Carrie, I know you're excited to welcome to the show.
I am. And Sarah Deer is the author of The Beginning and End of Rape, Confronting Sexual Violence in Native America, award-winning book. You are an amazing woman, Sarah Deer. You've also had a crucial role in the reauthorization of the Violence Act Against Women in 2013. You're an advocate, you're a professor, you are an award-winning author, and we welcome you to the show.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So,
now, Sarah, when we talk about all of the work you've done, obviously there's such an important angle to this, and that is the Tribal Law and Order Act, which was you were instrumental in, and the advocacy around the issues of sexual assault and domestic violence in the indigenous communities, something that a law professor, University of Kansas, not a lot of people have a lot of insight into, and you being one of the few people who are being inducted into the Hall of Fame, it's such an amazing accomplishment. So congratulations on that.
Well, thank you. I think I'm the 12th Native woman to be inducted, and maybe the 5th Kansan. There's not very many Kansans that have been inducted, so I'm joining the ranks of Amelia Earhart and the like with regards to that.
Well, congratulations.
Thanks.
You know, it's such a special time because we're approaching the 100th year of the women's right to vote. And the first American Women's Rights Convention was held in Seneca Falls in 1848. The Hall of Fame was established in 1969. And you have been really someone who has had groundbreaking success working in the American Native community, especially as it involves women and violence against women. Talk to us now about how you got interested in this and the experiences that you've had as a Native American in terms of the community and women's rights and victims' rights.
Sure. Well, I'm a citizen of the Muscogee Creek Nation of Oklahoma, where we were one of the tribes that came along with the Cherokee Nation on the Trail of Tears, where people are, you know, have heard of Cherokee, but not necessarily my tribe. And I ended up going to law school, I think in part because I was really interested in addressing sexual violence through the court system, and I wanted to be a prosecutor. And the, you know, the funny thing about that is I went to law school with a specific career path in mind, and it never happened. It happens, I think. And I think we have to, you know, tell law students that, you know, you might start right out with a passion in one area and flip. So I took federal Indian law my second year, and you know, I didn't grow up on a reservation. I actually grew up in an urban environment. And so I didn't know a lot of the laws and all the maze of confusing, you know, contradictory laws that Native nations have to deal with. So when I took that course, it sort of set me on that trajectory that I wanted to, you know, focus on the rights of tribes. But I also found that there was a huge intersection with violence. And so I was able to sort of combine my two passions and focus on violence on Indian reservations.
I was going to say, because when you talk about this, it seems like it's a challenge in any community, but perhaps in the Native community more so when you are bringing up certain taboo areas such as violence within one group of people. Is that something that you have had a big struggle with from the elders and some of the chiefs and some of the other male-dominated areas of rule throughout these tribes and communities?
Well, interestingly enough, a vast majority of tribes are actually matrilineal. And so the identity of a child, for example, is more closely correlated with the mother's lineage than the father's lineage. And that's not for every single tribe, but a lot of tribes are matrilineal. And so when you see patriarchy sort of present in a tribal context, it's usually the result of foreign influence. Tribes, you know, really didn't deny women political power until they were taught to do so by Europeans. And so you have this struggle, right, of you do have this strong heritage of respecting women in your philosophy of life, but now we have patriarchy that's sort of brought in, and we start using that against and to oppress women in that community.
And where have you seen the actual positive change? Because it says, you know, the essays point to the possibility of actual and positive change in this world. Are people, are you finding that this is being, this book is being passed around, is being bought within the certain tribes?
It is. I mean, it was published by an academic press, but it's gotten some reach in the sort of layperson's non-academic world as well. And, you know, what I really think we need to do, you know, because Native women suffer the highest rate of violence in the nation by far. And part of that has to do with the legal structures that govern tribes. So there's a lot of complicated restrictions on what a tribe can and cannot do, mostly imposed by federal court. And so you have to navigate this maze of can a tribe prosecute this person? No, only the federal government can. And it just really depends. It's very case specific. And that's why I think these cases fall through the cracks, is because when the legal system isn't working the way it should, it's easy to sort of let cases sort of fall off the radar. And that's why I think Native women suffer such a high rate of violence.
I'm sure, and I'm going to answer my own questions, probably does deal with the fact that there is such a huge drug and alcohol problem as well.
Well, I think, you know, the interesting thing is there was a study done in Canada a few years ago with that same thesis that it must be the alcohol and drugs.
Yeah.
And it is. I mean, there's no doubt about it. We have the highest rates of addiction when compared to other groups. But there's something more going on, because when they did this study in Canada with the Aboriginal First Nations people there, they actually controlled for that. So they said, let's look at a white community that has a high rate of alcohol that's similar to a reservation. The Native population still had even higher rates than that, even controlling for that. So I think that history of forced assimilation, extermination, the whole heritage of treating Native people as second-class citizens, I think all of that plays a role. You can't deny the role of drug and alcohol abuse, but even then, there's something more going on.
Do you think it's the work? Do you think it's a lot of times when you're just handed something, you don't feel like you're working for it? You don't feel like you have a purpose? And that feeling of, I mean, there's been so many studies about that. When you work for something, or when you feel like you have a purpose, that you're a happier person all around. You know, everybody, you know, whether it's the dad is working and mom is working too, or mom stays home, whatever it may be, but having a working family seems to change people's opinions about themselves, and there's more of a happier environment. What would you say about that?
Well, we also have the highest unemployment rate of any population in the United States. There simply aren't enough jobs on reservations. Right. And we haven't had, you know, unless you're very close to an urban area, your casino is not going to be particularly fruitful. And that's the stereotype, too. In addition to the drugs and alcohol and some of these other issues, all Indians are rich because they have casinos.
Yeah.
Well, only a handful of tribes really are truly wealthy. And they tend to be, you know, tribes near Los Angeles, right?
And so you
can't, the most tribes are still suffering from dire poverty. And it's hard to get an economic system up and running in these very remote areas.
Sarah, has the Me Too movement trickled down into the reservations and into the communities where there is, and I know, as you've mentioned, the laws are different, and there's some that may not be as progressive as some of the laws that are developing here or outside of the reservation, especially with the high-profile cases that are going on. And when Gloria Allred was on the show last week, she was telling us about going to New York for the Harvey Weinstein hearing and then for the Jeffrey Epstein hearing. Has that had an impact within the Indian communities?
You know, it's hard to say, because I think a lot of times these mainstream feminist movements kind of leave tribes out. You don't hear about us. We're not part of the conversation. But I've been talking to a lot of younger Native women. I'm in my late 40s. I've been talking to Native women in their late teens and early 20s. And the explosion of social media has really changed the conversation, because when I was in my 20s, we didn't really have the internet yet, and I couldn't connect with people around the country about similar issues, but these kids can. And so while Me Too may not actually be walking onto a reservation, individual Native young women are communicating about these issues more than ever before.
I feel like the Me Too movement has done something for people all around the world. I've heard this from people that I talk to, even in my advocacy work that I do with the elderly. But I also believe, too, that unless you have the means to do something about it, like you said, it's very hard because of the system doesn't really work with the normal, or the, you know, it's a tribal system, correct? So if you're not, right. If they're not getting the, I guess, the justice they deserve, how is that going to work? How's that going to change things?
You mean if we fix some of these broken laws?
Yeah. You work within, you know, the laws of the tribes or the laws of the Native American, what that may be, the laws within their laws, fix those, not necessarily, you know, the laws that they don't deal with. And that would be what we have to deal with. Now, let me ask you this. If a woman gets raped, there's sexual violence, does she have to deal with it within that, if she is living on a reservation, or can she go outside of the reservation and get help?
Oh, my gosh. It's a simple question, but yet so complicated, because there's a lot of questions that you have to ask, like, what kind of reservation was it? Where was the reservation? What state was it in? Was the perpetrator a native or a non-native? I mean, answering that question literally takes a semester in law school. I used to teach federal Indian law, and oftentimes I'm a younger woman. I'd give lectures about federal Indian law to groups of very esteemed, maybe older male audience members, and I think they think I'm confused because it's so complicated it makes no sense. But when a crime happens on a reservation, just a short answer to your question, when a crime happens on a reservation, if you're looking at the criminal response to that, that territorial jurisdiction puts the tribes in control. Now, they might share that authority with the federal government, and then depending on the state government. You see, so I'm already I'm already not making sense.
No, right? You make complete sense. That makes absolute sense. If they want to go outside of the reservation and get help, they can. Basically, it's as simple as that. But that it doesn't seem like they do that a lot. It doesn't seem like that's their norm.
Like so many legal issues, there's so many complexities, and I think that's really what we're hearing, and I wish we had a lot of time to talk about it, because it's fascinating, and I'm sure your students at the University of Kansas School of Law enjoy hearing about it. But in the last couple of minutes, I just want to talk a little bit about the National Women's Hall of Fame and the ceremony that's going to take place on September 14th. How did you first find out about this amazing honor that so few women are privileged enough to have?
I actually got an email, I think it was back in February or March. I had no idea I had even been nominated. So you can imagine my surprise when I opened up the email. I went and checked the from address to make sure it wasn't a prank. because I frankly didn't, I still don't know who nominated me, because that's how you are selected, is through a nomination process. Wow. So if you're out there, whoever nominated me, thank you.
It's so funny that you say that, because Gloria Allred said the same thing. She didn't know who nominated her. And then we actually found out on the show, it was the director of the documentary that was done on her called Seeing Allred. Sophia Sartain had nominated her, and she was so grateful for it. And, then to be able to have this honor and be selected, I know that everyone will be there, because I know Kate Bennett said that all of the inductees, if they're alive, will be there. Do you have family going? Do you have friends going to witness the induction?
I'm bringing my mother. She actually is retired with my dad in Tucson. And so I thought, my mom and I haven't done something just as the two of us for over a decade. And so I invited her to meet me out in Rochester and go to all the events with me.
Oh, that's wonderful. And especially something like this for women. That's fantastic. Yeah. Absolutely. Jane Fonda, I can't, that you have, so many amazing people. Gloria Allred, Jane Fonda, Diane von Furstenberg. Wow.
And someone that I'm sure you're interested in meeting is Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who has really been a trailblazer for women's issues.
In fact, I was talking to one of my students today, and she asked me kind of a similar question. Who are you most excited to meet? And I said, well, I don't think that's probably going to be too much of a surprise. I mean, I'm honored to be in this group at all. I'm not nearly as famous as some of, you know, my team, my cohort. And so, meeting Justice Sotomayor will definitely be a highlight for me.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, I really hope that you come back on in the near future and you give us an update and you tell us what it was like to be there, because that's going to be just huge. I'm so excited for you.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you very much.
I wanted to ask before we let you go, Sarah, are you going to be making a speech? And if so, what is it going to be focused on?
We get, I think, just 5 minutes to say a few words of thanks, and I'm actually going to speak some of that in my own language, the Muscogee Creek language, and just basically thank the organizers and my mom and everybody who's supported me for making this life that I have possible.
Wonderful. Well, congratulations on that. We're happy for you, and so many people should be proud of all of your accomplishments, and this is quite an honor, that's for sure, and thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Thank you. Well, Ellen, we have about a minute left. You're not here. I'm here.
So you have to close out the show. You know, Carrie, you always rely on me for 6 years. You've relied on me to close out the show, and I'm usually right up against the buzzer. Very few times. I know Wayman's always waving his arms saying, you got to stop talking. I said, I'm a lawyer. I don't stop talking. And that usually gets me right up to... what do you call it? The
like hitting your post or something?
Post. That's
there you go.
I always thought that was a hockey term, where if you hit the post, you don't score. But I guess if you hit the post in radio, you score.
I can throw you up against the boards if you don't stop talking.
I'm sure you'll give me a hip check. You know, it's Labor Day weekend. I hope everyone has a great Labor Day weekend. You know, it's a special time to respect all of the workers. Being a workers' compensation attorney and handling so many workers' compensation claims, I have so much respect for the workers of this country, especially those who, through no fault of their own, are injured on the job. That's what I do for a living. So this is really a special time to honor those people.
So happy Labor Day from Gervie's Law. Alan Gervie, Carrie Kasem, you're listening to 790 KBC. We'll see you next week.
This show furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.